Kennedy. I'm the principal here at Mansfield College, and it's my great honour to welcome here tonight Professor John Grieve. And I just wanted to tell all of you that he's come here to give one of the lectures in the Mansfield series of talks, really. I've known John for quite a long time. Professor John Grieve joined the Metropolitan Police in the late 60s and served as a detective throughout South London in every role, from undercover officer to police to policy chair on the drug squad. He was involved in the flying squad and the robbery squad and the murder squad, and I think I met him in most of those different roles that he had. In fact, it started in the 1970s when I have a distinct memory that the first time I met him, you have to understand, he was wearing an Afghan coat. He had wild hair. He wore John Lennon specs. He had a Zapata moustache. And he smelt of patchouli or something. And he was giving evidence against me, against my client. And the whole thing about it was that who wouldn't try to sell drugs to somebody who looked like that? And so I used to see him outside of court, and I would say, "You're an agent provocateur, and go and catch burglars." And he would then tease me back and say that, you know, he liked making me angry. But over the years, I had many different reasons to be involved in battling with John. And he became the divisional commander of Bethnal Green in East London. He worked in Europe, America, Southeast Asia, and Australia. He introduced asset seizure investigation in the UK. He was the head of training at Hendon Police College. And he organised community fairness and justice conference that was a seminal event. And I have to tell you that he persuaded the likes of me on a Saturday morning to go there to lecture to the police college. As the first director of intelligence for the Metropolitan Police, he directed and managed the MPS intelligence project, and he led the anti-terrorist squad as its national coordinator during 1996, from 1996 to 1998, when there were a number of bombing campaigns. In August 1998, he became the first director of the Racial and Violent Crime Task Force, and he retired in May 2002. And since that time, he's been doing all sorts of really interesting things in the academic world, but also, really, he's chaired the John Grieve Centre for Policing and Community Safety. He's a senior research fellow at Portsmouth University, an honorary fellow at Roehampton Institute and Surrey University, and an honorary doctor of the London Metropolitan University. John has been really at the heart of the whole sort of, you know, the underpinning principles of policing, and has been able to look at how policing has developed over his lifetime's experience, but always has looked at it in the sort of context of a much bigger picture. He's received many acknowledgements and honours, and including a medal for his contribution, and was made a CBE in the Millennium Honours List. And he walks and he paints and does all kinds of things. And I originally thought we might call this lecture, "Can You Be a Liberal Policeman?" But we decided that perhaps we should be more somber. So it's my great thrill, John, to welcome you here to Mansfield College, because you are one of the great inspirations to me in my professional life.
Gosh, I wish you'd said that about me when I was in the witness box at the Old Bailey. Interesting day today. Anniversary of the Bodleian Library opening. Anniversary of the Enniskillen bombing, where the mother of a friend of mine was murdered by terrorists. But I think much more significantly for me, it's the anniversary of the eve of Kristallnacht. And I've had this feeling for a long time that the police had done their job, and the police intelligence system had done their job, and thwarted Kristallnacht in Germany in 1938. In fact, if the police had stepped in and done all kinds of things in the 30s, we'd have been spared an awful lot. So, good night to be here. I've written it as a paper, no PowerPoint. I've had a week of PowerPoint and I'm as fed up with it as everybody else is. So I've written this. This is a sort of a preparatory version, so I'll be very interested to get any questions or any follow-up later for a chapter I'm writing for a book that's to be published by the Oxford University Press and is being edited by Jenny Fleming at Southampton University. Okay, so I plan on dealing with what police leaders should be doing, and then a bit about who those leaders might be in a changing society, and a bit about why. So there's a bit of theory thrown in. One of my colleagues at Portsmouth says, if it hasn't got theories in it, then it's not academic. It's a fairly optimistic account, but I'm going to be realistic, and there are a number of real problems for policing at the moment. So for the purposes of this paper, the police leadership arena considered here is both leading the public warranted sworn police and staff, and leading policing with a small p, the wider police family or police web, as Peter Manning, who is no apologist for policing, has recently called it. That's leading the variety of communities and disciplines involved in all the policing issues of a democratic civil society. Good example would be last year's leaders of all the arrangements, policing, security and otherwise, for the Olympics and the Jubilee. None of what follows is new. In 1977, Philip John Stead, a writer who I'm extremely fond of, writing in his book Pioneers of Policing, said safety, plenty and cleanliness, according to Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, are the objects of a good police. And I love the expression good police. It's a topic that John Alderson wrote about extensively, mentor of mine. Simply the internal administration of the community, whether city or state, its objectives was the way of life where people could be secure. We're all, of course, policed in this oldest sense by a multitude of domestic agencies. 20 years later, after John Stead wrote that, firstly, UK Labour government, now the coalition government, is seeking new ways to make policing more responsive to local democracy and leadership. Okay, here's a real criticism of police leadership that appeared in the Times, newspaper owned by Rupert Murdoch, but that's neither here nor there. All too often, police officers appear defensive, limited, robotic, and pun intended, a little plodding. The physical courage of the Thin Blue Line is not in doubt. However, its intellectual calibre and the leadership are unfair on my account. So maybe a bit controversially, I want to introduce you to somebody who I think is a very powerful and important, or was a very powerful and important police leader in the late 20th century and into the 21st century. And I've selected for that Paul Foote, a maverick journalist. I wouldn't describe him as a friend, but I've met him many times. I was a friend of his half-brother, Oliver Foote, who some of you may have heard of, great philanthropist, worked on the aircraft that flew around the world, DC-10 used to land, operate on people's eyes. And I met Paul Foote through Oliver, through Neville Lawrence. Neville Lawrence introduced me to Oliver, and Oliver in turn introduced me to Paul Foote. And I was the last person, I think, probably to interview Paul, not as a police officer, but as an academic researcher, asking him about his work in miscarriage of justice. It's perhaps symptomatic of how policing is viewed, that it's a journalist who is described as driven by a river revolutionary zeal for justice. What other descriptor than leader could be used to describe the policing improvements that followed 5 decades of his work? And I'm quite proud of 37 and a half years service, but 5 decades Paul Foote spent working stories and investigations that tumbled down the years. And there's a whole list of those things. In his obituary in The Guardian, they wrote about him being a steadfast beacon of integrity. He may have tilted at a few windmills, but like Shelley's West Wind, he was a spirit fierce, who stood against the vested interests of the corrupt, the power-hungry, the liars, the cheats, hypocrites and shysters. He didn't always win, but the great and good thing was he never stopped trying, and our journalistic trade, they wrote, was immeasurably the more noble for it. And I think that would be a lovely thing to be able to write about police officers. Now, this country has at the moment 5 great experiments in policing going on. I think that's probably unprecedented anywhere in the world. That's the United Kingdom. There are 5 experiments in policing going on, from which we can learn a great deal. There is the centralisation of 8 police services in Scotland into one, possibly in line with preparations for another kind of independence. There's the greatest ever experiment that's ever been conducted in accountability in Northern Ireland, following the Patent Inquiry, where they're probably accountable to over 40 different bodies. There's never been anything remotely like that in a Western democracy. In England and Wales, there is the experiment, well, I hope it's an experiment, with the elected police and crime commissioners, and it'll be fascinating to see where that goes over the next few years, based, in my opinion, on an American theory, which I'll come to later, if we've got time. And those police and crime commissioners have the powers to hire and fire chief officers, linked to the Tom Windsor reforms, which altered the terms and conditions of police service for England and Wales, and introduced for the first time for many years direct entry at inspector and superintendent levels of leadership. Windsor wrote, "What's needed is better and more enlightened management, managers with the skills and determinations to achieve." Now he used the word manage, and managers, not leaders. And then there's a London experiment. London's always different. It predates and is a variation on the police and crime commissioner thinking, which had a different evolution, has been varied by the elected mayor, but grows out of the chair of police authority thinking. And London has some vital national dimensions, but with all the community dimensions that you see elsewhere. And finally, there's the brand spanking new National Crime Agency, which has morphed out of the Serious and Organised Crime Agency, with a mandate to lead, coordinate and support serious, organised and, very interestingly, complex investigations. No definition of complexity yet. So it's all led to demands for improved leadership. A number of defining documents that might help understand the current policing environment. Human Rights Act, the European Commission for Human Rights, and the Commissioner's writing on the nature of investigations. The United Nations Code of Conduct for Law Enforcement and the Council of Europe Declaration on Policing. These have all got implications for police leaders. Against this background, and I'll get to the current or contemporary series of criticisms, against this background we have an increasing trajectory of challenges to the police and the criminal justice system and the state. For example, in the UK, selectively, The inquiries that are going on into the Hillsborough football stadium catastrophe and the role of policing in that. Stephen Lawrence inquiry, which is back in the news again on the front page, many years after his murder, with a new book by Richard Stone identifying new conspiracies. Lord Laming's inquiry into Victoria Climbier and all that taught us about policing. Bichard and Butler inquiries. I was really relieved to see Lord Butler on the Intelligence and Surveillance Committee interrogation of the heads of the intelligence bodies yesterday afternoon. Great admirer of Lord Butler's inquiry into intelligence and the Iraq War, particularly Chapter 2, which is all about analysis, which I actually teach my students and say it's as valuable to you in writing your essays and dissertations as it is to intelligence work. Damilola Taylor, murder of Zaid Mubarak, Zaid Mubarak in prison. Lord Scarman's three public inquiries going back, Northern Ireland, Red Lion Square, Brixton. Come back to Lord Scarman in a minute. The Windsor reports I've mentioned, Lord Leveson's inquiry into police relationship with the press and the criticisms that were made of some of that. And there were plenty of earlier and more widespread geographically problems in the UK. Thinking back, for example, to the death of David Olawale and the scandal in Leeds in 1974. In Ireland, I've already said, Patton inquiry. But you've also got the Bloody Sunday inquiry at 12 years and nearly £200 million, the longest running and most expensive review of policing in its widest sense, albeit a lot about the military. Judge Corey and his inquiries into alleged collusion and problems in policing terrorism. The Morris inquiry and the Bar judicial inquiries into the work of Angada Shikana in the South. And if you want to look across at America, there have been challenges over the Ruby Ridge siege, Jersey Turnpike, racial profiling, the FBI, laboratory challenges, challenges to the policing in Brooklyn, Los Angeles Police Department, Pennsylvania, and the role of police sexual predators. Now, many of those events, inquiries and patterns have identified that what has been called the continuing crisis in police leadership globally, and there have been a number of people who've written about it. To my mind, I don't think there's a complete account yet, which is why I'll be interested to see how Jenny Fleming's volume works out. Now, on the one hand, these challenges have been facilitated by lawyers. Whoever else might be in the room as a lawyer. From the 1980s onwards, the independence of the prosecutors and their standards and leadership, and they definitely took the lead in a number of areas, for which they get very little credit, as well as from defence and cause lawyers. Cause lawyers is a neutral term in policing terms, representing campaigning families. On the other hand, educated customers of policing have driven demands about more general aspects of leadership, politicians, and the media. Ethics. Before I get to ethics, it's worth just saying that these challenges are not, these kinds of challenges and the kind of people who are challenging things is not limited to the police. Although I concede, as a former police officer, that the challenges to the police are extremely important. But you can also list challenges to the medical profession, the banks, the church, the BBC, the military, and dare I say it, Parliament itself. And there's a thread that runs through some of this, the response. And I suppose one of the threads I want to explore is ethics. moral disquiet of committed concern, policing practitioners themselves has always been an issue. A lot of this stuff came from within. A long time ago, when I had my Afghan coat and beard and a lot more hair, one of my leaders was a man who was known to us as Grim Jim Barnett. He was a detective chief superintendent. We thought he had absolutely no sense of humour. However, when he retired, he wrote a thriller, long out of print, which was called Head of the Force. It was a near whodunit, but it was, and it was about the murder of a senior police officer inside Scotland Yard. But he had a line in there that stayed with me ever since. He said, "We release young cops into a moral minefield, and we don't help them draw a map. We don't help them how to survive in that moral minefield." And I suppose he published that in the 70s. And I was somewhat surprised when the Home Secretary said what we needed was a code of professional ethics, because to my certain knowledge, those informed practitioners within the service have been working on different variations on codes of ethics since the 1980s. In 2000, a couple of researchers who taught at the Police Staff College, Rob Adlam and Peter Villiers, analysed 150 accounts of police leadership, and they came up with six principles, which I think map very well onto Lord Nolan's principles. I was once asked, not in the witness box, but when I was applying for a job, I was once asked by Baroness Kennedy to explain the Nolan principles, and I'd learnt them off by heart at the time and gave you an acronym for them, as I recall. So I think these ones by Rob Adlam and Peter Villiers, they map very well onto Lord Nolan's principles, and I'm not sure that I actually see the need for any more. And Rob and Peter wrote, there was a principle of service, and the public service goes to the heart of this. There's a principle of unselfishness that you can expect from public servants, but with no sense of personal reward beyond that contracted, a form of altruism, possibly. Principle of strategic awareness, haven't got enough time to get into strategy, but if you've seen Lawrence Friedman's magisterial account of strategy, my goodness me, what a good book that is. I strongly recommend it. I'm just working my way through it at the moment, 700 pages. He's at King's College, London. Used to be at Newcastle when I was a student there. I've had dinner with him. That's the closest I get to that scale of thinking about strategic awareness. A principle of support. On my account, that's a task for leaders to develop both the operational ideas and plans of their teams, but also their followers' personal development. And we were talking just before we came in about how careful you have to be not to let that principle of support degenerate into misplaced loyalty and overemphasis. A principle of professional excellence, I prefer that phrase, professional excellence, and indeed subject matter expertise. And I always saw myself not as a professional, but as an artisan, as a craftsman, much more in keeping with that. Keeping up with the changes of legal interpretation, keeping track of community concerns, and how those two threads can interact. And very relevant to today, horrible phrase, horrible expression, Pleb Gates, principle of endurance with integrity. This relates to resilience and ethics despite many pressures, complexities and ambiguities in public lives. So two or three questions. I read philosophy at university and psychology, so I like asking questions back again. And it would have been good fun to hear what you've got to say about it. What is policing? It's a public service, but is it a craft? Is it an art? Is it science? Is it social science? Should it be a profession? Is it artisan work? Is it philosophy? Is it complex or is it simple? Are all of these or none of these disciplines relevant? And second, what does any of that mean, if anything at all, for policing leadership? Third, policing is an activity which takes place in a constantly changing, dynamic, shifting environment with many challenges, not least those of postmodernism. This requires the skill to adapt, not least amongst the leaders. What are those adaptation skills in the 21st century? There are complicated rules, human rights balances, for example, which can create the effect of the ethical minefield, the moral minefield that I've described to you from James Barney. And some of these problems at times seem to be near intractable to me. Fourth and lastly, but massively important it seems to me, policing attracts the attention not just of politicians, academics, journalists, lawyers, and the various commentators, but to a much wider public. Imagination, television, documentaries and dramas, films, literature, including the classics such as Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, a book we've discussed in the past, and Dickens, go back to Dickens, Bleak House, I much prefer Dickens to Wilkie Collins, Dickens' Bleak House, or Our Mutual Friend. Our mutual friend, of course, the mutual friend, the definition of mutual friend in that book is death and the investigation of it. Mr. Inspector Bucket, I'll come back to maybe later, and the night inspector in Our Mutual Friend, who's never named, tell us a great deal about the nature of policing. So, something about a moral minefield, something about what General Wolfe called options and difficulties. There is, sometimes for policing, the answer is the least worst option. Something about how do we need to adapt, and whether policing can be seen in terms of being a complex adaptive system. What can we get from, for instance, the revolution in military affairs, the learning that's come out of Iraq and Afghanistan, by the army. Mentioned professional ethics, but I'm also interested in a concept that two writers called Bennis and Thomas came up with in 2002 for the Harvard Business Review, which is called the crucible of leadership. They call it the crucible of leadership, painful, sometimes traumatic experiences of leaders, which often require adaptive thinking. I suppose that's a bit like a phrase, or a stronger phrase than, if you can't take the heat, don't go to the kitchen. I just want to mention another matter connected with the military, which I think has some bearing on the police and crime commissions issue. And that's an American writer called Elliot Cohen, who wrote a very important book to my thinking about Supreme Command and the relationship between politicians and the military, which has been extrapolated to look at the relationship between the police and politicians. And I know it's had some influence on coalition thinking, because he's been invited at least twice, to my knowledge, by one of the think tanks close to the government, to be part of a debate about the nature of the relationship between local and national policing and the commissioners. It's a really good book, I think, Elliot Cohen's Supreme Command, deserves wider reading. He takes four exemplars: Lincoln, Clemenceau, Churchill, Ben-Gurion. Interesting. Each a genius statesman at war. And he looks at their four styles, written, in the case of Lincoln, His chapter on Lincoln is called Lincoln Writes a Letter, based on wide reading and great attention to detail. In the case of Clemenceau, appropriate as we arrive at the anniversary of the First World War, although he didn't become Premier of France until 1917, regular, weekly, visiting. He wrote off a day every week to go and walk on the front. They'd never seen a politician there before. Visiting and talking, sometimes called management by walking about. Churchill, he describes as questioning an extensive, detailed follow-up amounting to an interrogation and drill down on the issues. And Ben-Gurion, total immersion in the issues and taking part in debates, including holding seminars for his military and intelligence leaders. Now, it seems to me that's all about communication, which is hugely important in the 21st century, and we need to tidy up what we actually expect from the police in terms of communication. Post-Leveson. I'm happy to answer questions about Leveson later on. Now, this was described to me by a recent Metropolitan Police Commissioner as an exquisite difficulty, how to deal with communicating with communities and everybody else. And he described it thus to me: I have to listen to my colleagues, intelligence officers, CBRN, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear cadre of experts, tactical firearms investigators, advisors, politicians themselves, civil servants, but also to the communities and the media to assess the impact of all kinds of possible outcomes on them. When I was coming to the end of my time in counter-terrorism, just before I moved on to try to solve some of the issues that were coming out of Stephen Lawrence inquiry, I met with a group of highly decorated members of a very famous regiment that prefers to be nameless and don't like people talking about them, who are experts at applied, not to say fast time, potentially lethal intelligence-led operations. And they gave me a large, signed, first edition academic book. It was about the Navy, which is interesting for some army officers. And they wrote inside the front cover, which I still have, delete military, insert police, and you have the answers. That was Andrew Gordon's brilliant book, The Rules of the Game. We translated that as The Rules of the Blame. And Gordon looks at what he calls blinding glimpses of the obvious, and he takes the period from Nelson to the Battle of Jutland, so nearly 100 years, over 100 years, and he looks at how the Navy developed, the regulators, who were those who thought that there should be rigid rules, a tactical doctrine for every occasion, and the rat catchers, by contrast, who were innovative, adaptive and flexible people who made the system work. And we translated that into some of our thinking. So there is, of course, a role for both rat catchers and regulators, as Admiral Sandy Woodward pointed out in the foreword to Gordon's account. And that took me to some more advanced thinking about what were the actual principles of policing. If you could do that sort of analysis of what the Navy was up to, what could we do about ourselves? And one of the things we came up with was rethinking some of the intelligence issues. Came up with the principle that perhaps that policing is about foreknowledge of problems, back to Kristallnacht again, and questions about possible, useful, practical, sensible answers in real time. As Nelson and those soldiers had known, there's much to be gained from looking for yourself, as well as there was much to be learned from books, let alone the Times Law Report for cops. So, intelligent policing, I suppose, is one way of looking at it. Rob Reiner, professor at the LSE, once said to me, oh yes, John, intelligence-led policing. Intelligent policing, that would be the opposite of stupidity-led policing. I promised something about Lord Nolan, just to remind you of what Nolan said that he required from public servants. Selflessness, integrity, objectivity, accountability, openness, honesty. Useful to be reminded of that at the moment. And leadership, which meant promoting all the other six standards by example. Right, I want to move then from some of the what to some of the why. I once got a letter from Lord Scarman after he did a lecture and a workshop for me. Very thoughtful man, Leslie George Scarman. And he wrote to me, it's in his handwriting. I love it, I've got pinned into my copy of the Scarman report. And he wrote, the more complicated police work becomes, the more necessary it is to ensure that the principles of policing a democratic society are not lost in the complexity of the action. I'll say that again because I think it's so important, almost more important than some of the other things he said in the actual report. The more complicated police work becomes, and I believe it is complicated, the more necessary, and becoming increasingly complicated, the more necessary it is to ensure that the principles of policing in a democratic society are not lost in the complexity of the action. And that seems to me to be a fundamental task of policing leaders. I started off with Paul Foote. Let me introduce you to two other people who I think are leaders in policing, and that's Mr. Neville Lawrence and Baroness Doreen Lawrence. I can go back over the public inquiry, if that's what you'd like, later on. But I think one of the great gifts they gave to policing were the family liaison officers. And I've long thought, I mean, we'd always had a job, get a job on every homicide inquiry to be a family liaison officer. But it wasn't a discipline in its own right. It wasn't like driving or firearms or forensic science or crime scene analysis. Although it was beginning to emerge as a task, and Avon and Somerset Police had explored it, and we stole it, the idea from them, lock, stock and barrel, post the Stephen Lawrence inquiry. And I've long thought that the family liaison officers, whose job it is to be investigators, but also to talk to the family, with all the complexity that comes out of that. I've long thought that they should be called Stephen Lawrence officers. We trained a massive cadre of family liaison officers as a result of Neville and Baroness Lawrence's activities. But we're also driven by a woman who I had huge admiration for, Dame Cecily Saunders at St Christopher's Hospice. She and St Christopher's taught us an enormous amount about dealing with bereaved families. And having introduced two women into the account, just want to say in passing that one of the things that's driven the ethical changes that I've seen from the 1960s to today is the arrival of women in considerable numbers into the police service. It's only taken 90 years, so I suppose it's not very good. But recently you had the head of counter-terrorism, or the currently two of the heads of counter-terrorism, the two most senior people in the United Kingdom in counterterrorism are both women. The head of the flying squad, unprecedented in the days of John Thorpe and the Sweeney, which I was proud to be a member of. Didn't have quite as long hair in those days.
Those were your flying squad days.
Those were my flying squad days, the Sweeney days. Head of the flying squad, head of the murder squad, head of special branch, all women. They've had a massive impact on policing and police thinking. Okay, so that's enough really about some of the what. Let me say something to you about some who issues. I wanted to introduce you to two friends of mine, both deceased, who I think epitomise the sort of police leadership that Paul Foot would have identified with, and that Neville and Baroness Lawrence I might have identified with them. Because we're podcasting this, I'm not going to give you their full names. And one's a leader down on the street, one was a leader down on the street at the lowest level of investigations, and one was a leader both there and at the highest level. And I'll use that list to come to an end. First one's a detective constable, who shall we call Ron. Street level study. When he left school, he went to sea for nearly 10 years, became an officer, travelled the world. Joined the Metropolitan Police, married, had three children, became a detective, served all the way across London, and eventually nationally. Committed himself to lifelong personal development up to master's degree, engaged in charitable works, and died in office as a detective intelligence officer on a task of national importance at a time of considerable peril. Those, my lady, are the brief facts, as I would have said to you before you started to persuade the magistrates not to send your client to prison. But that doesn't sum up Ron for me. He was a specialist homicide investigator. People of London were truly fortunate to have him to make their communities safe. He was a man of enormous integrity. And there were communities, not just in London, but across the UK, who benefited from him. At the time he joined the police, it was the habit to get you to write an essay about why you were interested in joining, and he wrote extensively about teams, and he was the ultimate team player. However, he developed something as a result of the Stephen Lawrence inquiry that I can picture now. I can see the reports he wrote now, and I've read a lot of police reports in nearly 40 years, and there's not many of them I could actually describe to you, but he invented a way of dealing with community impact assessment and how you assessed what a possible police operation looked like and what impact it might have on different communities. I can't tell you how important this is. And why it demonstrates the kinds of things I was talking about that Lord Nolan and Paul Foot would have required. And I can see his use of coloured pens. And I can see how he adapted over a period of time reports so that you were left to think very clearly about the outcomes of things that we could do. My second case study is about a senior, well, somebody, we all served all the way through the ranks. Somebody I knew from the time he was a sergeant to the time he was a deputy chief constable. Tom, shall we call him for this? He was a police officer, but he's also an academic, a researcher, a theologian, a moral entrepreneur who valued ethical leadership and reform. could tell you an awful lot about Tom, but let me pick out one thing he did. In the 1970s, as one of a series of police disasters, a public inquiry was set up, the Fisher inquiry into the murder of Maxwell Comfrey, which led in turn to the Phillips inquiry, which led in turn to the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which dramatically altered the way detectives could operate. And it was predicted that that was the end of investigations, that we'd never be able to work again. Tom, by that time, was an inspector and read psychology at university, and almost single-handedly he crafted the response to that. He showed, and he then conducted the training, and then he drove it. He showed that it was possible to interview people ethically, to keep a record of it, to have it filmed, to have it taped. He drove what is really a paradigm shift in an ethical version of policing. His obituary, written by David Rose, included this: building from the analysis of mishandled interrogations and miscarriages of justice contained in his 1990 Kent University PhD, in fact it was earlier, it was from his undergraduate dissertation, Tom was at the forefront of a radical shift in police interview techniques and training, determined that the one-time emphasis on getting a cough at any cost should be replaced by a neutral search for reliable and durable evidence. The drive of what Tom called ethical policing dominated his working life. From his time as a young officer in the early 1970s in the Complaints Investigation Branch, where I first met him, when he investigated me, a bit like my friend here meeting me, asking me questions in the witness box, he used to say to me, "Well, let's see if that's true, shall we, Detective Constable Grieve?" You know, and you'd think, "Oh, here we go." And she'd say, "Can I see your pocketbook?" As if I'm going to say no. As if the judge is going to let me say no. I went off on a tangent there. Tom would have loved that. Tom had been instrumental in establishing the criminology department that I now work at, partly, at Portsmouth University. And he was still working there on academic pieces and books, editing other people's work, including my own, and keeping his sweeping intellectual curiosity to the end, despite being seriously ill with cancer. And he wrote some good books. So those two case studies, I think, something that Paul Foote would have identified with. Paul Foote once said to me, "Do you know, if I hadn't been a journalist, John, I'd like to have had your job." So I think, well, I'll repay the compliment, Tom. I'll repay the compliment, Paul. I'll offer you this job tonight. You can have my job. Let's see what you can make of it. So in conclusion, none of this is new. Charles Dickens, the first journalist to describe policing from the perspective of a participant observer in 1852, translated his findings into his novels Bleak House and Our Mutual Friend. In Bleak House, his famously ambiguous protagonist, Mr. Inspector Bucket — I won't describe him as a role model for me, because there was real ambiguity about him, but he's a very interesting character. He describes intelligent policing, Dickens — bear in mind, this is 160 years ago. And he goes like this in Bleak House: There he mounts a high tower in his mind and looks out far and wide. Many solitary figures he perceives creeping through the streets. By degrees, we seem to contract our search between narrower and easier limits. Single police officers on duty could now tell Mr. Bucket what he wanted to know. That seems to me to be an account of the leadership task. Recovering the word intelligence-led policing for communities. Spent a long time trying to build a community-friendly intelligence, police intelligence. Fascinated by what's been going on over the last few months. So a general thesis about police leadership for the 21st century might be to make intelligence non-threatening to communities. And the tool for that would be what Ron designed, community impact assessments informed by risk analysis and human rights. To achieve this, we need informed leaders. Maybe there's somebody sitting here tonight who'd like to become a police leader. Consenting, educated partners, but also participants. We need educated, knowledgeable communities and customers as fellow leaders. And I think I'll stop at that point.
I just wanted to raise a number of things that you might want to deal with before we can open out more widely. I mean, there is a big debate going on currently about a number of things that I'm sure, you know, you must have a view on. Let's just run through the sort of things that there are on the table. There's the issue of undercover officers and the big debate that's going on just now about the fact that there are very serious allegations by women, and they seem to have substance, that they were involved in environmental political groups, and that undercover police officers infiltrated their pretty benign groups by and large, and entered into relationships with women and perpetrated deceptions that led them to believe that they were genuinely having relationships, and in one or two cases, children being born as a result of those relationships, and then suddenly those men who were operating as undercover agents disappearing. I mean, there's something goes wrong when the lines that shouldn't be crossed are crossed in that kind of way. And what could have happened in policing in terms of the oversight? Now, you've been an undercover officer, and that I know. And although you can't talk about the kind of operations that you were involved in over the many years, it's one of the things that you're known for in police circles. I mean, how does that happen?
Good question. Huge investigation going on into that. Anybody that thinks there is a cover-up when those kind of investigations go on is balmy, quite frankly. I have never seen anything remotely resembling the scale of the investigation that's going on into that and related issues, because of the related issues that come out of it, like the issues of the smears on Mr. and Mrs. Lawrence. And I'm caught in the splash back from that, and I'll tell you something that's already in the public domain about that in a moment. As an undercover officer, I was an undercover officer in a much earlier and easier age. It's now possible to track people's history. Very difficult. I didn't need to have the identity of a stolen identity from some poor people's dead child. You will have seen me in the witness box using my own name, using my right name. But I was employed to deal with bank robbers, drug traffickers, handlers of stolen goods, all those kind of things. I think that's a very much easier job than very long-term infiltration of groups. And yes, the innocent get caught up in that sometimes. I'm not going to defend for one moment lying to women about the nature of your feelings for them. That seems to me to be beyond Nolan and Rob Adlam and Pete Villiers. However, there are some difficult, dangerous people out there who you have to go through a chain of events to get to them. And whether the way this was done was right, and whether the decisions were made correctly, is something that we're going to have to wait for the full facts. But on the splash back onto me, just so that you understand that this is not cover-up and, you know, of any kind, I've just spent 6.5 hours talking to two barristers about a decision that I made 14 years ago in about 10 minutes on the street. You know, so to be asked to account for things, and I genuinely believe in lifetime command accountability. I didn't ask anybody else to answer that for me. I didn't ask the current leadership to answer that for me. I dealt with that myself. I think that stays with you forever. I'm not sure how adequate an answer you would find that if I was in the witness box.
But it seems to me that if you're going to have intelligence-led policing, in its most benign form, it's about having the kinds of relationships with communities where they are going to trust police enough to divulge information about things that the community are concerned about, that people will take the police to one side and provide information, or you will have people who will be kind of embedded. I mean, in some circumstances, those things are necessary. It just seems to me that you then have to have, it goes back to Lord Scarman, that you really have to cling to principle when the terrain is becoming more complicated. I mean, it's like the arguments one's had recently over the importance of maintaining principles around the rule of law, even when you're involved in, you know, international war, where you're involved in the possibility of receiving evidence that might have been based on torture in other places. You know, somehow there has to be a body of principle that becomes the more important the more complex the territory is. And so, you know, isn't that the answer? When it comes to this sort of stuff, if you're really embedding people in organisations and you're running them, it becomes the more pressing on the leadership to ensure that those people are not getting involved in relationships which are going to have serious consequences for innocent individuals.
I absolutely agree, and I think that is a statement of the moral minefield and how much you have to go back to understanding principles and the rule of law. Counterterrorism is a good example here. There is the so-called war on terrorism and the military responses and all that can go wrong with that, having spent 7.5 years working in the peace process in Northern Ireland when I stopped being a cop, the problems that you cause for the military and for the police, if you have a military solution, or do you say this is a policing problem and thus it is an issue for the criminal justice system, and thus it's an issue for what matters you can put in front of the court. And I absolutely agree, revisiting the principles. Big debate in academic circles about the Peelian principles of policing. Did Robert Peel actually write some of that stuff himself? Or is it an interpretation from the 1930s from Charles Reith? And I've just spent a lot of time sitting in the National Archive in Kew, working my way through Peel's papers, and I can identify 4 of the Peelian principles now that you can take back to Peel's a statement. And one of them is something he said in a speech, which was that the police should not usurp the role of the judiciary. And I don't think he was thinking, you know, I think the interpretation today rather would be it's not about the judiciary, it's about the criminal justice system, not usurping the criminal justice system. And if the policing methods cannot be used to support something in the criminal justice system, then something else is going on, but it's not policing. However, it is an area of exquisite difficulty, as I said, and I haven't got the answers to all of that.
I want to mention another of my concerns. And I think you were saying that when you were looking at the issue of ethics, that that this is not confined to police, and I would agree with that entirely. That the ethical issues confronting our society just now, which have been manifest in politicians fiddling expenses, being prepared to accept bums and things in order to be involved, shifting of policy and so forth. The idea that you've got journalists who are prepared to hack into phones. We could go around the territory and look at the ways in which we've seen a drop in ethical standards. And what seems to be at the heart of it is the way in which, and it goes back to your mentioning of how when it comes to the business of service, that it's about having no sense of personal reward beyond the contractual. And what we have seen is that, you know, the Leveson thing, and you mentioned that you might come back to it, you know, it wasn't exposed enough. Was that part of the problem was that police officers were prepared to kind of, you know, pass on information because they would get there was a drink in it. And you and I know from all of our lives involved in the criminal justice system that that phrase of there's a drink in it has been around for more years than we can count, of people getting backhanders for giving in, you know, giving the heads up when personalities were coming into the courts, of leeching out certain kinds of information that wouldn't normally be given to the media, that sort of thing. And what seems to have happened here was that was going on in a particularly insidious way.
This is exactly what it was like in the witness box at the Old Bailey. She asked me these questions. Absolutely. Okay, so Leveson, I'm the independent chair of the Hate Crime Independent Advisory Group for the Attorney General and the Ministry of Justice and the Home Office. And the group suggested to me that I should write to Lord Leveson to talk about some of their concerns about the way diversity was represented in the press. Fortunately, we decided against that because I thought giving evidence to Lord Leveson was my idea of an extremely bad time. But we also knew, you and I, or know to this day, some extremely ethical journalists who wouldn't dream of behaving like that.
I was going to try very hard to be here tonight.
I know, and I'm really grateful he's not here because he'd asked me a lot of very difficult questions.
He's in the south of Spain somewhere.
He is, indeed. I checked up on that myself. Lord Leveson. I never remember one single solitary boozy lunch. I never had any champagne with journalists. Martin Brunt from Sky News, another journalist I've got a great deal of admiration for, came up to me the other night and said, John, where did all this stuff about champagne and things like that come from? So, yes, there may well have been some appalling relationships. Well, I don't mean well there may have been. I mean, there obviously were some appalling relationships. But you have to have. I don't think Philkin and Leveson have truly understood the necessity for the police to communicate at multiple levels with communities. And the media is the route to which it should go. And writing down all those things has just caused paranoia. So that people are terrified, I'm told, of being seen in the company of journalists and discussing things with them. And the much maligned background briefings by which she used to try and get people to, journalists, to understand what the actual issues were, seems to me to be hugely important. I must say that, no, I won't say that because it's about a current trial, so I'll stay away from that. I'll tell you that in private afterwards about another mutual friend of ours and something that was said the other day. Yeah, I don't think we've got fully to the bottom of the relationship between the press and the media with Lord Leveson. I'm a big admirer of Lord Leveson. I mean, on my victim's account, he pioneered with us during my time at Hendon, and with another mutual friend, he pioneered the victim statements. He did that early work with us. So, big admirer of him. I think in some ways his hands were tied by the ongoing criminal inquiries and the trials that are going on. And it occurs to me that that's a good defence for me at the moment. My hands are somewhat tied by the ongoing trials and the criminal justice system, and not to usurp a power
of the
judiciary.
Good. I see that there's a hand coming up there.
Good evening. I'm a recently retired head teacher after a long career in teaching. I was head teacher of four schools. I work as an independent consultant now in working on school improvement. I have fulminated for a very long time in the example that set children by politicians, by the police, by the press and various other bodies. The job of educators is to educate the next generation. I think the public bodies need to clean their act up. I think it's an absolute disgrace. How are we expected to raise a generation of law-abiding, respectful citizens when the example they're set on the media, we see it through the media, is so disgraceful? I mean, Baroness Kennedy, the example set on in the House of Commons is a case in point, Prime Minister's questions. We're expected to teach children to listen to other people's points of view, to listen to people's points of view respectfully. But what do we get? Abuse, jeering, catcalling, and the police, of course. Look at that Joanna Yates murder. And the amount of backhanders that were going on there. I just think somebody ought to set an example and make life a bit easier for the educators in this country so you don't get the problems, the police don't get the problems with the younger generation. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I absolutely agree. That's my lifetime command accountability. It's why I'm here tonight, 14 years after I packed that in. It's why on Monday morning at 9 o'clock I will be with my second year undergraduates trying to persuade them that there is more to life than falling asleep in my PowerPoint lectures, and that I've got things to tell them about the nature of thinking through problems. But I absolutely agree with you. It's a huge responsibility on this generation. It's not even my generation anymore. I'm getting to be the generation before this one. And I think it's appallingly difficult to be a young person. I think that the demands and the pressures from the media, from advertising, from their peers, from social networking, all appalling. And deeply worrying.
And just, we're trying to set an example.
Yeah,
we're teaching the children a code of ethics.
Yeah, I agree.
And what they see on the television completely undermines the whole thing. From people like the police, like the press, and the politicians, who all ought to know better.
I agree.
We're going to send you out to lecture to them. We're very fortunate tonight that we've got Commander Chris Adedit, who's the most senior police foreman in Britain, and has come tonight too. And I just wondered if, Chris Adedit, if you would like to say something about
the way in which John has suggested that the arrival of women has had an incredibly beneficial effect to the, if you like, the culture of policing. President.
I think that's a bit hard, you know.
Yeah,
she came as my friend to support me. It's like turning up at the Old Bailey to watch your team and suddenly being put in the witness box.
Yeah. Not the first time. I did come to listen. So I joined in 1983, and there weren't very many women, and it was a very macho culture, and those of you that can remember John Thor and that kind of thing, it was not so far removed from that. Crazy things like, in order to be a dog handler, you had to have a wife.
You can get the food for the dog.
I could go on. And we were in the middle of the miners' strikes when I joined, and you, as a woman officer, you weren't a public order trained officer, you therefore didn't go to any of the policing of that. And I sometimes wondered whether it would have been any different if there had been more women there, I don't know. And it has changed absolutely hugely. So Helen has kindly introduced me. I'm the most senior officer responsible for counterterrorism and protection and security in the country. My two deputies, as John said, are both women. And most of the deputy assistant commissioners, the people who run the operations across the top of the Met, at the moment happen to be women, and they have been for a few years. Different women, but more women than men. And I think you do see a slightly more collaborative approach. I think you do see a slightly more human and humane face of policing. I don't want to overstate it. I think it has changed hugely in the time that I've been in. I don't think very much of that is to do with women, but some of it is. And I suppose the frustration, to come back to, for example, one of the comments recently made, is I know that the police service that I'm now in is so much more professional, so much more accountable, so much higher standards, actually, so much more open, I could go on, than the one I joined. But the image is not, I think, in some respects, and I suppose it's true of all the kind of big institutions, that we are properly much more accountable, we're properly much more scrutinised, and one story, one issue can become an enormous drama for a very long time. You know, I was in charge of investigating parliamentary expenses, the people who were abusing criminally the use of expenses. I got infuriated by seeing in the media people thinking that is the way all politicians are. I meet politicians every day, and most of them are very selfless and do set good standards of behaviour and performance. But there's something about the way in which we look at people's conduct now that I think is very hard to measure up against. People say it all the time, this probably sounds hollow. I honestly believe not only is it hugely better than it was 30 years ago in policing, but it's better than just about anywhere else in the world. Most people in the world live under a place where the criminal justice system is profoundly corrupt and profoundly ineffectual, and the police service ditto. That is not the case here. It's absolutely not the case here, but it doesn't always feel like it to the public, what they see in the media.
We also have with us Lord MacDonald, who was the Director of Public Prosecutions, and who also we did cases with you, indeed, all three of us together.
My idea of a nightmare, having a pair of them here.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Chris has just said. I mean, I was Helena's first pupil, as it happens.
I taught him all he knows.
In 1978, and so I had my first experiences of court following Helena around. And it was a very bad time, John, actually. I mean, it was a time when there was a lot of, I would say, routine corruption in policing, in the sense of, you know, the old system of verballing, and some of you won't know, but before 1984 in the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, police officers were allowed to give evidence of confessions which hadn't been contemporaneously recorded, and the result of that in our perception, and you may think that our perception was warped in some way, but in our perception this was a fairly routine form of misconduct that was profoundly depressing if you were working in the courts. And I remember, as you indicated during your presentation, that when the Police and Criminal Evidence Act proposed tape-recorded interviewing, the reaction amongst many officers was, well, no one's going to confess to anything on tape and it won't work and the system will collapse. In fact, as we know, although interviews became a little bit too long, in my view, the system didn't collapse. And the extent to which guilty people could make false allegations against the police declined. But I certainly agree with Cresta. I think, I don't practice in the court so much anymore, but I sit as a judge at the Old Bailey occasionally. I think the standards generally have improved dramatically. I think some of the standards of advocacy have declined, actually.
Yeah.
I think that's gone down. I think the bar is not...
Sorry, Sue, because we were sympathetic.
Yeah. I think that there hasn't been improvement on that side, but I think the police are... There are far more young black officers, there are more women. I think there's still racism in the police, there's still racism everywhere, but it's not nearly as common as it was. I mean, I don't mean to sound complacent, but there are still problems. I think there's still too much there's too much dishonesty from time to time. But that's true again in all institutions. My overall feeling is that the improvements since the Police and the Criminal Evidence Act, and certainly over the last 10 or 12 years, have been quite dramatic. And I think at the level of serious crime, I think the work that Cressida's people do and people involved in investigating serious crime are you know, world class, actually. And honest. I mean, I don't think we ever did a terrorism case where we felt that the evidence had been dishonestly obtained or they'd been stitch-ups. When I was DPP, I worked closely with the Metropolitan Police in serious crime, and I was very impressed with the way it was conducted. I thought the ethical standards were extremely high.
You came in slightly at the end of that, because I mean, I did the Guildford 4 appeal, which came out of a trial. I did the Balcombe Street siege.
The 70s were
bad because, you know, that people got, I mean, confessions were obtained in highly questionable ways, as we know, and was disclosed. But certainly once those lessons of those miscarriages of justice were kind of becoming clear, I think that there was a real clean out and it became a very different ballpark. I'm going to tell a very brief story about how both Ken and myself were in the bombing of the Israeli embassy, and you were in charge of that investigation. And I remember our client got off halfway through.
I'd say it was innocent. I wouldn't say got off.
She was innocent. She was really innocent. I mean, people always say to you, how do you feel about representing people that you think might be guilty? And that can be very trying. But the most difficult thing is when you're representing somebody that you really believe is innocent, and the burden that you carry with that. And it became very clear, I mean, it was clear to us, to Ken and myself, that she was innocent. But it became very clear, happily, in the course of the trial that she was innocent. And afterwards, it was very interesting, this just tells you something about this man, was that Nadia Zekra was Palestinian in origin and was a middle-aged woman. And when she would go back to visit her dying mother, every time she came back into the country, she was detained at Heathrow by immigration for, 9 hours, long, long periods of time, because they still had her flagged up in some ways as being a questionable person. And I got in touch with John and brought this to his attention, and you cured it. Not only was she given a letter that she could carry to show to people that she was deemed by police to be innocent, but also that you got it through to other sections of the Home Office that was the case, so that she wasn't subjected to that anymore. And you know, not everybody would have made that effort, and I thought that it was an example of your high integrity, your thorough commitment to high ethical standards and morality, and it's been one of the reasons why I think you have been a great policeman.
Just on Lord MacDonald's point, that's the end of the allegations of verballing. Well, it wasn't totally the end, but it cut verballing back to virtually. That's why I picked on Tom Williamson as a case study, and just to go with your account of representing people in terrorist trials, she used to talk to me out the corner of her mouth outside the number one court at the Old Bailey, saying, "Don't speak to me, don't smile at me, I can't be seen to be a friend of yours, I'll probably get topped by..."
Kneecapped by the IRA.
But her clients were, of course, all innocent.
They were innocent, of course.
I always thought that, don't try and carry my books for me, don't be a friend of mine today. No, I think everything you said, Sue, was absolutely bang on. It was hugely important, and it's a great tribute to the people who drove that through, but I was just trying to emphasise that some of this is driven by informed, ethical practitioners from within, and, you know, and Tom had far more courage than me. I'd have, you know, he had a terrible time driving that in. You know, he was told by more senior officers to mind his own business. What was he doing this? And yet he made a massive contribution. You're quite right, they're far too long, and, you know. Yes, sorry.
Well, listen, I think that now is our time to retire and to thank everyone for coming along, but particularly to thank you for giving us such an interesting set of insights, and also a sense of, I think, confidence and hope that, in fact, that we do have a very incredible policing service. Thank you very much, John. That was wonderful. Thank you.